Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show, friends. Today we have with us from Phoenix, Arizona, our friend Zach Lynn. How you doing, Zach?
Good. How are you doing, Luke? Good to be back on the show.
Yeah. So I just was looking earlier today, and you were on back in January, February, April of last year. So it's almost been a year since you've been on. So
yeah, life great. Is. And you get awesome guests. I have to say, like that's some kind of talent you have. Is you end up with curating a very impressive list of guests for your show. So I want to congratulate you on that.
Well, thank you. And to be fair, you hooked me up with the Rob Bell interview, or you helped with that. So
right.
Some kudos to you on that.
Well, you know, it's my pleasure. I'm glad you got to talk to Rob and Kristen.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so next month, flying out to Albuquerque, New Mexico to hang out with Richard Rohr in person.
That's awesome.
Pretty pumped about that one.
He's amazing. He's like he's kind of like I've met him one time, and he just sort of reminds me. I sort of felt like I was like in the presence of Obi-Wan Kenobi. You know, like he's kind of got this vibe and this presence about him that's really cool and calming, and he's amazing.
Yeah. So I got to talk to him, you know, a few months ago, and it was just amazing. He was the like kindest, most gracious person in the world, and yeah, I'm very excited to go out there. And he said, when I was emailing with him, well, I don't know if it'll be worth your time to come out here and talk with me. And I'm like, you know, I've got a stack of all your books that I've read. I'm pretty sure it's going to be well worth my time.
Yeah, he's great. He's great. Have you seen, you should check out, I think I can send you a picture of it, and maybe you can post it like on your podcast page or whatever. But he has this sort of bullet point, I think it's a PDF or a page of like an alternate orthodoxy.
Yeah. You've showed that to me before.
It's so good. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's great.
You know, before I interviewed him, I think I asked you to send that to me again because I saw you post that on Twitter sometime and I wanted to see it again.
Oh yeah. You know, I'll try to remind me and I'll send it to you.
Yeah. That's good stuff. Have you actually been to I think it's called the Center for Action and Contemplation.
I did. We did a show in Albuquerque, and I went over there and just checked it out. I don't think he was around, but it was cool. I just sort of was creeping in the corner, just sort of looking around and checking it out. It was cool. It was really cool.
Yeah. Did you by any chance do the Breaking Bad tour while you're in Albuquerque as well?
I did. Yeah, and I have lots of cool photos from that.
Yeah.
But yeah, we totally nerded out on Breaking Bad for sure.
That's definitely my agenda, is I'm going to go see Richard and then I'm going to go around and do the Breaking Bad stuff.
Okay, we're going to need to talk offline about that. I'll give you...
Okay, definitely.
I'll give you lots of information and photos.
Great. I'm glad that you're as big of a Breaking Bad nerd as I am.
Totally.
Yeah. So what are you up to these days? Your band, obviously, if people don't know, you are the drummer for the band Jimmy Eat World. You guys aren't touring right now? Correct?
We're not touring. We're actually taking a break. We've never, like, this is like our 21st year in being a band. And so we've never really decided to say, hey, everyone can, like, not have to worry about doing anything related to Jimmy Eat World for a little bit less than a year. So it's like about, I think it's about, in total, it'll be about 11 months or 10 months. So we're, like, all kind of just sort of doing nothing, and I think each guy is kind of doing something, you know, like Rick, our bass player, he's right in the process of starting a business, a distillery actually, so he's doing that, and I think Jim's working on music and doing some shows, solo shows, and I'm working on some music on my own, and so yeah, we're just all kind of doing our own thing.
Okay, now obviously we're friends now, but more importantly, I'm a fan of the band. And so this scares us. We saw what happened to Blink-182. They just split up. You guys aren't, like, you're going to get back together, right?
Yeah, it's certainly not like a breakup at all. It's just sort of like everyone's, you know, like after 20 years of never taking a break. Because if you don't actually say, hey, we're taking a break, then there's sort of like this thing in the back of your head that's like you're obligated to... The requirements of being in a band. So, like, you're thinking about songs, your brain is constantly going on, like we're doing this, even though we're not on tour, even though we're not in the studio, you still kind of have like this obligation to move forward, create, think about everything. And so like just for, and we've never actually taken a break where we said, listen, everyone can just like turn that switch off in their brain for 10 months and not like have to worry about thinking about what they need to do for something. Like,
yeah.
And so it's really not like a, we're not breaking up or anything like that. It's just kind of like, we're just, you know, we're removing the obligation from each individual band member to contribute to the band for 10 months so that they can do whatever they want to do, you know? So,
yeah. Okay. So I got two questions. First one, how does that conversation come up? Like, hey, I was thinking about, I want to be away from you guys for almost a year. I mean, like, how do you just like have a band meeting and say, we're going to take a break, or does
a
manager?
It was like we were last year going into 2014, like we made a goal, like we want to write a full album during that year, you know? Mm-hmm. And we started going down that road, and it was just kind of like, it just wasn't happening. Like something didn't feel right. Something kind of felt forced about it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, and then also last year was like our 20th anniversary as a band. So we were thinking about that a lot, and we sort of felt like, you know, maybe this is a good indication that we just need to take a minute to step away and like, you know, not think about, not have that burden of like, we got to make a record, we got to do this, we got to do that. Like, so I think it just sort of out of the creative process, it sort of gave us a hint, like maybe we should take just a step back, take a time, get a breather, and then regroup next fall, and then just like see what happens, you know. And that's kind of what we're doing. So it's certainly not like an official breakup or hiatus or anything like that. It's just like we're just taking a minute to kind of do something different for a few months, you know.
Yeah. And so hopefully when you guys get back together in the fall, there'll be more creativity and new insight for kind of the next step in the journey. Is that the hope?
Yeah, you would hope so. Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I think that, you know, yeah, like we're gonna get back, and I would expect that it would just feel a little lighter. So I think that's kind of the hope.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm really struggling not to make a reference to your song "Bye Bye Love." So like, don't sing that to each other, because that'd be really, really awkward. So,
no, that's not happening. Yeah.
Okay. Good. I don't want to do that. Or okay, I'm going to stop with the cheesy puns based on your music, because it makes me feel like a huge nerd. Because I've got about two in my head. I'm just going to edit those out, hopefully. Okay. Hey, the reason we're talking is I just posted an interview with our mutual friend Richard Beck. You guys actually just first met just a couple weeks ago in Phoenix, right?
Yeah, we hung out together at the Christianity 21 conference, and that was the first time I'd actually had a chance to meet Richard in person. And it was awesome. You know, he is such an influential writer and thinker in the way that I sort of, he's helped me a lot, and just through the books he's written, and then his blog is just a monster.
Yeah.
So I really appreciated his work over the years, and so it was great to meet him and his wife Deanna, who's awesome, and Holly, my wife, and I went out to dinner with them, and had a great time, hung out, and his talk was awesome, and so it was a blast, and the conference itself was great as well. So.
Yeah. Okay, let me tell you one story about his wife. I booked this NT Wright interview a few weeks back, and I'm texting with him. He said, hey, just give me a call and we'll talk about, you know, what suggestions for questions to ask. And I call him up and he's on the phone and he goes, hey, Janet, guess what? Luke just booked NT Wright. And she starts cheering in the background. Made me feel so warm inside that she was happy for me. Such a nice lady. So
she is an awesome lady. Yeah. She's so great. Like immediately you get awesome vibes from her. Like she's just a good person, a good lady.
Yeah.
You know, super warm, and you kind of like, she's like, you know, those people that you meet and you almost feel like, you know, you're really good friends immediately. And that's like the kind of energy she has. So yeah, it was great meeting her, hanging out with her, hanging out with Richard. And, it was awesome. You know, and it was like, I introduced Rob to Richard, and, you know, Rob is a big fan of his, and like got it, you know, so it was like, it was kind of cool for me. It was like these, you know, both Rob and Richard, who I've learned so much from and mm-hmm. value in so many ways. It was cool to see the forces combined.
Yeah. I think people would really enjoy hearing that conversation, Beck and Bell talking. I think that would be,
It would be great.
Yeah,
it would
definitely.
Be great. They would be awesome together.
Yeah, definitely. Did you meet Beck, or, you know, virtually get to know Beck through his blog first or one of his books?
Well, the first thing, was his blog. So I learned about his blog, started reading his blog, and just, like, you know, loving, you know, everything he posted. It resonated with me. And then his book Unclean was just a total game changer in so many ways for me. And I ended up, like, I love that book. I ended up teaching that book to an adult Sunday school class at the Mennonite church that we go to. And just, you know, it's just such a great book with such strong material mm-hmm. that, you know, it's just the stuff he talks about in Unclean is something you encounter all the time in life, in daily life, all the time. So it's like, it's just very, very helpful. I Unclean was a huge, huge book for me. And then all of his books since then are awesome. Like I'm going through Slavery of Death, and you know, he's such a great thinker.
Yeah, definitely. I'm completely ripping off some of his stuff tomorrow night, my Ash Wednesday service from Slavery of Death.
Oh yeah. That's like total wheelhouse for that kind of material.
Yeah, definitely. Did you read his blog post he did a few weeks ago about the laundromat?
Yeah, I thought that was awesome. I thought it was a great idea.
Yeah, definitely. But then, like I said this yesterday in the podcast, I was like, but that makes me feel guilty because I don't like going to laundromats, and I like to stay in my confined, comfortable places and not kind of go out there. And so he makes me feel guilty, but it's very, very good stuff. Very good stuff. Okay, so the reason, Richard Beck, here's the connection here. So I was talking to him on the podcast, and he brought up the C21 conference in which you also were presenting at, and I was asking him what you were talking about, and he said, you know what, you just need to talk to Zach about it. And so I thought, that's a great idea. So let's get you on the phone to talk about what you discussed at the C21 conference. And it was, to no one's surprise who follows you online, to hear that your message was about the gospel. It was the gospel of Phil Collins or something about Phil Collins, right?
I titled it The Gospel According to Phil Collins.
Okay.
And so Tony Jones, who's a friend of mine, asked me to speak at the conference. You know, it sort of made sense because the conference is in Phoenix. I'm here. And so he asked me to speak. And I didn't really know. I sort of told him, like, you know, I need a sort of specific thing to talk about. Like, I need to be assigned something specific to talk about because, like, I sort of felt like as a musician, I'm not a pastor, I'm not a writer, I'm not a blogger. Like, I don't do any of those things. And so, like, I'm not going to be able to get up there and say, okay, let's unpack some theological concepts that will help you in what you're, you know what I mean? Like, that's not what, you know, people don't want to hear that from me. So I didn't really know what to talk about. And I think I asked Tony, like, I need a specific thing, you know, and I think he was kind of joking, but, you know, he follows me online. And so he said that we need to hear, like, you know, the gospel according to Phil Collins.
Yeah.
I think it was just sort of like a joke, you know, but then, like, I sort of thought about it and I was like, that's perfect. Like, I'll do that. That's exactly what I'll do. And so I just sort of decided I'm going to figure out a way to present, to the people at the conference, like, what I've learned through listening to Phil Collins. And that's basically what my talk was based on.
Yeah. And in all seriousness, you talk about Phil Collins all the time. I was at my pool a couple months ago, the Nautitorium where I go swim once a week. And some coach had left speakers in the water, which really annoys me. I don't like to listen to anything while I'm swimming. It just seems like unbiblical or something. You shouldn't have music underwater, right? That's not Christian, I don't think. And I was mad about it. I was like, there's music underwater. And then I started to listen, and it was a Phil Collins song. It was the Can You Feel It Coming in the Air Tonight?
What's it?
And I was like, well, Zach would be proud of this music, so maybe I'll just be happy with it. And of course,
probably swimming a little faster than normally would, you know, getting pumped up.
I mean, how can you not be pumped up listening to that song?
Yeah, exactly.
But then I thought, well, maybe this is about the lifeguard who's not going to help me when I'm drowning. And I thought, oh, this might be quite ominous. Anyway, so you're a big Phil Collins fan.
Yes.
But if I understood what Richard was saying, Phil Collins and like a serious drummer in a rock band does not typically go hand in hand together. That's not typically the music people are expecting you to be listening to.
Right, yeah. I think the thing is that, you know, when like growing up and being in like being really into music, growing up as like a teenager, playing in bands, you know, there was kind of like this sense that, you know, if it was really popular, if it was on the radio, then it was uninteresting, you know. So we immediately sort of wrote off like big popular music, you know. Mm-hmm. Like when I was in grade school and I was watching MTV, like behind the back of my parents, you know, like, so like I'd sort of sneak in watching MTV before my mom got home from work. Like I was super into like Bon Jovi and U2 and like all the big bands, but that, you know, I was like 9 or 10, right?
Yeah.
But then as you get into your, you know, as I became a teenager, I became more and more of a music snob. Like, you know, I started liking bands like Fugazi and, like just a bunch of obscure punk bands that
people
didn't really know of. And like, it was almost like a badge of honor. Like, oh, okay, cool. I like all these really cool bands and, you know, I completely dismiss anything that's like mainstream or on the radio. So like, I'm so alternative and I'm so cool.
You're like
so
a hipster, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, I only listen to bands that Pitchfork gives good reviews to or whatever, like, you know, any equivalent you want to make, but basically that's kind of how I was. And, you know, and then part of it was meeting my wife, and she has an incredible taste in music, but she, you know, she would be listening to stuff like Phil Collins or Peter Gabriel and stuff like that, and like I would be like, oh, okay, well, you know, I kind of would make fun of her a little bit, or like there'd be something that she did like, you know, that she liked, and I was like, oh, that's, you know. But as I got older, I sort of realized the error of my ways. You know, I started to discover, like, probably when I was, you know, in my, you know, probably when I was around in my mid-20s, I started to kind of come around and think, this Tom Petty guy is pretty good, actually. Oh, hey, this Bruce Springsteen guy is pretty cool, too.
Yeah.
And, like, started reconnecting with some of, like, the people who I just sort of dismissed before. So Phil Collins is kind of, like, just, you know, I guess just the ongoing is part of the ongoing process of opening myself up to things that, like, maybe before when I was younger, I just sort of closed myself off to because I thought it wasn't cool.
Yeah, you're too cool for that.
So that's one of the things, like, that's the first point that I used as my, you know, as my, in my talk, is like the first thing I've learned is that when you become a Phil-cyple, you get mocked. Like, people make fun of you. Like, they're like, why are you listening to Phil Collins? Like, this is, like, he's such a lame, you know. And so what I learned, part of it was the idea that, like, there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure, and that if people are making you feel shame and guilt for enjoying the creative expression of someone else, I said, that's satanic.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, like, if you like conform to the idea that someone's creative expression, if you enjoy it and that it should make you feel bad or feel shame or, you know, then that's also going to inhibit like your own creative, like those feelings and thoughts are going to govern the way that you create yourself, you know?
Hmm.
So like, you're going to be creating, like, let's say you writing a song or writing a sermon or writing a blog post, and you're thinking, I got to write this so that the right people like it.
Yeah.
You know, then you're basically short circuiting your creative process. You're not being true to what you want to say. And because you're out of the gate, you're starting to, alter your basic instinct to please the peanut gallery in your mind, that you think, oh, well, I'm going to do something that this person is really going to like.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that that's not really, I think, I think in creativity, like, it's okay to do that every once in a while. Like, it's okay to say, I'm going to, as an exercise, try to do something that this person likes. But as like a baseline fundamental, like a place of being creative, like it's not healthy because
you
are just going to be chasing the approval and, you know, of others, and it's going to limit yourself creatively.
Yeah, one of the things that I've heard some of my other preacher friends talk about is having to remind themselves that their homiletics, their preaching professor from seminary, is not with them in the auditorium when they're preaching on Sunday. And for so many of them, it's like, or so many of us, we feel like we have to preach sermons in such a way that we get a good grade in homiletics class instead of worrying about, you know, what actually the congregation needs to hear or what God's doing inside of us or what, like, the average person who just shows up at church for the first time in, you know, 6 years really needs to listen to.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's a big thing. And I just think in life, that's a big thing. Like, mm-hmm. you know, so many guys I know who figure, like, somehow, like, in their some, you know, like, I've seen it a lot, like, guys in their mid to late 20s, early 30s, run into huge obstacles trying to meet the expectations of somebody. Like, typically it's their dad. So, like, they're running into major, this idea of living up to an expectation that their parents put on them or that they have for themselves. Like, oh, well, I'm 32 and I'm not married and I should have had, like, my job and my wife and my kids. And then all of a sudden, like, none of that's happened. So my life is a mess and I'm panicking and, like, you know, let's go to the bar. Like, you know, you just see that all the time. And there was this really great book. I forget the title, but it's a guy named David Data, and he has a chapter in the book that says, "Live as though your dad were dead."
Oh, wow.
And I think that, you know, obviously we all love and appreciate our fathers, and but that is sort of like a thing that happens where people sort of live to please or to fulfill some expectation, and it may not be from your dad or maybe from someone else, but it's like, just that kind of saying puts it in a way of, like, you have to sort of do your own thing and you have to pursue the things that matter to you and not worry about the expectations. Like, be okay. Like, so, okay, well, I'm not married. I don't have, like, the six-figure job and, you know, but things are fine. Like, I don't need to, like, it's okay to set expectations for yourself and do things like that. But it's like, once you start kind of, like, trying to please something out there, then it can oftentimes lead to, like, you know,
yeah,
like
it's destruction. Yeah, definitely. Now, your dad was a big baseball guy, right? He was a playing in college, was a minor league coach, right?
Totally, yeah.
And so obviously, you go the music route. I think, did you play baseball growing up, and then you eventually left that for music?
Yeah, exactly. But the thing about my dad is, like, I think because of his baseball experience, like, my dad is probably one of the most supportive people, you know, in my musical career. You know, because I think he understood, like, when I dropped out of, you know, junior college and my mom was freaking out because I'm dropping out of college, mm-hmm. I think my dad sort of, like, he kind of had the same experience. Like, he left college early to go play baseball. And, you know, he got drafted by the Astros. And so, you know, so I think he sort of connected with that idea of taking that risk, doing the thing that, like, you know, 9 times out of 10 isn't going to pay off, but, like, pursuing it and trying it. And so he's always been... You know, my dad has always been, like, awesome in that regard. Never made my brother and I feel like we had to play baseball. Mm-hmm. Never gave us those expectations. In a lot of ways, like, my dad, you know, didn't kind of set up, like, this sort of expectations for me that I felt like I couldn't achieve. Like, I always felt like he had my back and supported me. And, and I'm hugely thankful for that because I see other guys who aren't as lucky, and they do kind of get that sort of, like, oh, well, you should have had, you know how like the dad strategy of, I'm going to motivate you through disapproval.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I see that happen all the time and it just backfires, you know, it's not a great strategy, but it's like, it seems so common in especially, like, you know, our parents' generation, but then even their parents, you know, our parents' parents' generations, like, that seems like such a common strategy, but I don't think it's
working. It never works that well. It doesn't work. Yeah. And luckily, I have a father who, very supportive, always encouraging, never was trying to, you know, play that card with me, and I'm very grateful for that. And I think it helps you not live in fear. Like I had a friend once who we were probably 19 or so at the time, and he was asking me to hand him a hammer, and I handed it to him backwards or some way he didn't like, and he kind of snapped at me and goes, "Oh, I'm sorry, but you know my dad would always yell at me if I did that." And it was like reminding himself of like a father who would always get on him if he did anything wrong when he was helping around the house or was supposed to do in his life. And it kind of like made him gun shy, like the dog who's been around a gun too much, that he's always scared that there's going to be this loud bang that he's going to be terrified of. And that's not good for anyone. And so when you live kind of always trying to find that approval, you don't have the comfort and the confidence to be creative like you want.
When, totally.
Okay. So your buddy, Rob Bell, I was listening to a sermon from him years ago, and I don't know what in the world he was doing in the sermon to use this, but he played a clip of Kanye West's song Power. And so this is probably 5 years ago. And I thought, I've never heard a preacher somehow quote, or not just quote, but like actually play a 30-second clip of Kanye West in their sermon.
Right.
And my first thought was, like, what other church would let you do this? And my second thought was, like, you clearly have like the full spectrum out there of things that you can communicate and articulate your point using. And so there's like this confidence that okay, someone's not going to like this, but I have like the confidence to try to be creative and do something that might be different in the hopes of being able to articulate and communicate something.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so like this idea of not being afraid and not living out of like this idea that I've got to please the peanut gallery enables you to be more creative, right?
Yeah, it enables you to sort of do things. Oh, that's unexpected. Like, because if you have that sort of constant fear, you know, of that constant fear of like failure, then you're gonna, you know, like, yeah, you're gonna shy away from taking risk. And that actually ties exactly into like the second thing that I talk about in the talk. Like the second thing I learned is that even the greats, like Phil Collins, fail. Like they take a risk and they blow it, you know? Mm. And so what I did in that, so every point I had coincided with like a song clip.
What was the song for?
So the song that I used as an example of his failure is the Genesis song, I Can't Dance.
Oh yeah. That's
and it's
good.
Like, so, you know, and honestly, like, you know, I actually like the song. Like, it's a good song, but there's also elements of it that like it just kind of like it's a total creative risk on Genesis' part, but it's just not it's sort of always sort of looked at. It's not taken seriously as a song.
Huh. Why is that? Why isn't it seriously taken?
I think if you remember the video and the song, like, it's just like super nerdy and dorky, but there's sort of a charm to it. Like, so there's elements of the song I really love. Like, I love the sort of, I love the sort of sentiment behind the song. But I just sort of use the song as an example of like, musically, creatively, the song, like, I just don't think it's very good. It was a risk that they took and it didn't succeed. Mm. And so basically the point is that they are willing to take the risk and they're willing to fail. And like, even the best people, even the people who are the greatest of all time at something, you know, like they are taking those risks and allowing themselves to fail. Because you know, those are things that you can learn from. And, you know, so that fear of failure is, you know, if that hovers over your creative process, then it's going to diminish, you know,
so
it's,
like,
it's going to diminish your output.
Yeah, definitely. So like for you as a musician, do you find yourself as you guys are in the songwriting process and whatever it is exactly that you do as a drummer to write a drum thing? I clearly know nothing about music if you didn't realize that already, but like, have there been times that you've gone, people aren't going to like this, this could really fail, and that you pulled back on something that in hindsight you wish you would have kept going forward with?
You know, I think that whenever we're doing stuff, we all sort of like, I think collectively are listening to it and asking each other like what we think. So it's kind of based on our own intuition, and we don't really, we don't consciously ask ourselves, like, will people like this? Will people won't like this? Typically, the songs we really love are songs that, like, you know, end up being sort of like deeper album cuts, you know, that aren't as popular, you know, and it just sort of ends up being like that. But, yeah, I mean, I think part of it is just, you know, it's mainly the point really is just that, like, there's a danger in sort of taking yourself so seriously that you're not, you can't stomach, like, the idea of the crash and burn. Like, you know, like, you can't, you're avoiding doing things because you're not, you know what I mean? Like, I think it's the willingness to take risks and to open doors for yourself creatively that, you know, because, you know, it's like when bands do that, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but at least they're doing something different, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Now, you have some connection to David Crowder, don't you? Do you know him?
Yeah. I do.
Okay, good. Because I thought I saw something years ago and your, like, name was on a blurb or Jimmy Eat World's, something. Okay, so he's done a lot of stuff now where he's bringing, like, the banjo into his music and he's going, like, really, like, Texas country in his stuff.
Yeah.
Which, I live in Texas, so I have to have some, you know, appreciation for country music, but it's not really my go-to. But what I really appreciate about it is that he's willing to, okay, this is not really a normal genre, like worship music, kind of however you describe it, like typically does not have the banjo in it like he's doing. And I really appreciate his willingness to at least try that, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, he's always been the kind of guy that I think he sort of is, yeah, he's never seemed shy of taking creative risks and doing stuff that's like unexpected. You know, and I think that that's just, you know, he'll always be like that. I think he'll always try to take risks and do stuff that a little differently. And that's what I think sets him apart from so many other, you know, Christian songwriters.
Yeah, definitely. But as a musician, it seems like your listeners would have to have an evolving taste as you, as a musician, would continue to try different things and be willing to kind of go where you're going with your music.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, you know, it's a balance, you know. So, like, for instance, we've been a band for 20 years, right?
Wow.
So there is, like, a thing that we do that we sort of, over the years, you kind of find your voice as a band of what you do and what you're good at. And then, you know, so there is kind of, like, a lane, I think, that you I think, not necessarily stay inside the lane, but it does kind of give you that center of gravity creatively, because, like, if you're a band, right, and you do something and you kind of create this voice and identity for what you do, and then you decide, oh, okay, well, you know, we're this sort of bluesy rock band. Okay, we're going to do a disco record, you know, like it sometimes can, like, it just sort of throws off your audience in a way that's not always good.
Yeah.
So I think that, like, if you want to do that disco record, then you should, like, kind of creatively work your way that direction, you know, or, you know, like, you have to kind of, like, you know, it's like you can't take a ship and, like, try to steer it at a 90-degree angle. Like, it's just, you have to kind of move it gradually, you know, because I think you do want to kind of appreciate your audience in a way where you don't make huge, massive changes, you know.
And
but I think within the parameters of like trying to honor your audience, you can work within that to do things that are a little bit different, and you can take creative risks within that space.
Yeah.
And I think it's just more, it's okay if you want to go do that crazy concept record that sounds nothing like your material,
mm-hmm.
but you know, you may alienate some of your audience. And if you're comfortable with that, cool. But if you, like, actually want to keep making music and you want to, you know, if you want to kind of keep your audience together, and then it might be good to sort of, you know, if you do those kind of risky things, it's always good to, like, have something, you know, like, have something that's either released at the same time or close to it that's more kind of, like, in the sort of wheelhouse of what you do creatively.
Yeah, so what you're saying is if you're a country musician and you want to do a rock album, you need to change your name from Garth Brooks to Chris Gaines and pretend like that's not even you. That's what I hear.
Yeah,
you
see, like that's an interesting example, because like he's, you know, that identity change allows him to opens up a different space creatively. That's not what he does. You know what I mean? So that's actually a very smart way to do that. It's like, even though I don't like Garth Brooks at all, that is a good way of doing it. You kind of create. By creating a character, you create a space, like an alternate space that you can play in, that isn't rooted to what you do as as Garth Brooks. Yep. You know what I mean? So, okay, yeah, I think that's cool to do.
Okay, so first of all, I'm going to just kind of revel in the fact that I actually had an astute musical observation. So first of all, good job to myself. Second of all. Okay, the C21 conf, was it called C21, Christianity 21, or I'm just kind of made up that acronym like it's correct?
I think C21, I think it's called Christianity 21, but I think that the hashtag was like C21.
Okay, for my intents, we're going to call it C21 from now on. So at the C21 conference, I'm assuming you're talking to a lot of pastor types, writers, speakers.
Yeah.
When you're telling this to them, obviously you kind of get the parameters of what a pastor does and what a speaker is doing when she's up there to talk.
Yep.
What does this look like for her when she's getting up there to make like a sermon? What do you think that would look like for them?
Like, what do you think? Oh, yeah, in terms of the things that I was saying,
being okay to fail. Like, what does it mean for them to be comfortable, for us to be comfortable to fail as a pastor speaker type?
Well, I mean, I think sometimes you're trying to articulate things that I think Rob Bell is a great example. Like Rob would, I think this sort of falls into the category of sort of stirring up the hornet's nest a little bit, but not being afraid to lose members at the expense of telling the truth. Mm-hmm. Well, to say, well, I'm going to say this really difficult, thing that we're wrestling with, and it's going to make some people upset. It's going to create some tension. To be able to, lean into that with some confidence rather than sort of shying away from it, it really could be anything. I think it's just a matter of being, if you're never failing, if you're never like taking a risk and sort of eating it, then you're not really trying as hard as you could try, mm-hmm. Like it may not have to be related to a theological, controversy, but it could just be in the way that attempting to make something more memorable. Is a risk. Sometimes, being a little bit silly or being a little bit, kind of out of the norm of what a pastor might do can sometimes make something more memorable.
No.
It could be anything. It just depends on what people's shortcomings are, what they sort of shy away from in fear of doing something different.
And so it's good to probably figure out those things that most terrify you. If it's like being embarrassed, well, that's good to name what that fear is. If it's, losing members, if it's losing income, those are good things to name and to at least know this is what's in the peanut gallery dictating my creative process. And I think that's helpful. Okay. So we've got 2 points here. Be mocked. Even the greats fail. Is there a third point that you had?
The third and last one I had was that, I sort of used the idea of a song has a way of sort of burrowing into your soul, like you can listen to a song like 10 years ago and not have heard it for 10 years. And then I could play it for you. And then you'd be singing the lyrics and you'd know the melody and you'd remember, I remember, how do I know this guitar solo note for note from a song I heard there's a way that we have, we carry around these songs with us. But they sort of go dormant because we don't listen to the song. And then when we hear it, years later, it's like, oh, yeah. So I used I used against the Phil Collins Against All Odds as like an example. So I said, I'm going to play this song and then I'm going to stop it. And then if you know the next lyric, like raise your hand, right? So I play like a part of the verse of that song and I cut it off right before the chorus. And as soon as I cut it off, like every, like half the people in the auditorium is like, start singing the chorus of that song, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's an example of that, you know, and so it's an example of that. Basically what I do is I tie it into why I go to church, you know? Hmm. So I said, like, for me, the reason why I go to church is because, like, I know these things, right? Like, the truth of the gospel that helps me be a better person, it helps me live life more fully. Like, mm-hmm. I know all of those things in my head, but the thing is like, we so quickly forget things. Even though we carry them around with us, we don't engage them because we just kind of forget. We get busy with, like, you know, we got to pay bills, and we have to take the kids to soccer practice. And it's like your days are filled with this sort of busyness that, like, you forget the things that matter, you know? And like, for me, going to church, like walking through the doors of church, seeing the faces, singing the songs, like, is a really base level way of just reminding me, you know, you are, you know, a person that needs assistance. You need help. You need to go through this process to be reminded of the truths that you know, but you so easily forget, you know? Mm. So like, and so that to me is like the most powerful aspect of going to church. It isn't necessarily what's said in the sermon. It's not necessarily like what's being sung or what songs they sing or if the worship pastor is good or, you know, whatever, if there's enough candles or whatever, you know, like,
yeah.
None of that is as important as just simply being reminded of these basic things that, as a community, bring us together every week and you know, to be reminded that we are people who need help. We need to recognize the ways in which we, you know, cause pain, the ways in which we hurt others, and then connecting with our community, and then connecting with the shared beliefs of our community, and doing that on a weekly basis, just kind of reroots us every week. It's just a reminder, you know? Mm. And so, like, in a lot of ways, like, songs especially are really good reminders. Like, because we hear it and, like, oh, we think of that time in our life, or we think of, like, the thing we were doing when we were really into that song, or there's just something about music that sticks with us and sticks in our brain. And then, so that's kind of what, like, I just kind of said, like, as a writer, as a pastor, or whatever you're doing, like, your job is to remind people of something. You know, that's the base level of what you're there to do, is you're there to remind your community of the things that matter, of the things that, you know, whether it's, you know, theological truths or whatever. It's just something that brings us together, that reminds us of the things that need to get us through the next week.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Man, that's good. That's really good stuff. It's easy for us pastor types to think we need to give some new idea and to give some insight that no one's ever heard before. But a lot of times what we all need is to be reminded of some of these base things that we need burrowed deep in our soul. Zach, that's some good stuff right there, man. Be careful. You might turn into a pastor.
Well, thanks. Well, I mean, you know, the thing that's really helpful about this for me is that it helps me so much as a person who goes to church. Because I used to be, you know, and I still am in my weaker moments, but, like, I've tended to be this guy who's, I'm listening intently to the sermon to make sure there's no theological, like, you know, implications that I disagree with, or I'm constantly policing, like, oh, well, this, you know, like, I hate, like, contemporary Christian music. I hate it, so it's like, oh, this is, you know, so like, it's so easy for me to walk into that environment and just start to kind of like do the math on every aspect and, like, you know, pick it apart and try to kind of determine, okay, well, what's this pastor trying to say with this thing? And, you know, and identify like all the blind spots in this guy's sermon or whatever. And so for me, as just like a person who goes to church, it's so much better just to kind of go with this sort of recognition that none of that stuff really matters at all. You know, it's like I so much more appreciate the sermon for what it is, and I don't try to like make it something that it's not. And I so much more appreciate the music because it's like I'm not, you know, I enter into it with a less critical mind, and I'm just sort of more like thinking of the really basic things. Like, it's great to be here to be reminded of like the things that that I need to be reminded of, and it just the sermons become more influential on me because I'm receiving them with a more sort of like in a more open way rather than a closed off way.
Yeah, Zach, that's good. I'm going to make everyone in my church listen to this little talk you gave. I like that. That's really good. Okay,
before... Well, I'm all about lowering the bar. You know, like let's lower the expectations, and then we're going to be happier.
Yeah, that's what 12 years of marriage have taught my wife. You know, just don't have any good don't expect much from Luke. Just be surprised when he does something decent. Okay, I got a couple of questions before I get out. First of all, true or false? This whole talk should make me not feel guilty about liking Taylor Swift. True or false?
Oh yeah, it's true.
Okay,
absolutely
good.
Not.
Good.
Like I think Taylor Swift is awesome, so I don't think there's any shame in liking Taylor Swift.
Okay, good. Because I was going to reference Taylor Swift's "Shake It Off" song when you're talking about how the greats fail, and she was making fun of her inability to dance. But I censored myself because I didn't want to fail, and so thank you for letting me feel good about that. Okay.
Yeah.
Next talking point. I meant to talk to you about this. You had a show, I guess it's probably 8 months ago down in Fort Worth, and went to it, brought some of my buddies. We had dinner beforehand. Great time. My friends were huge fans of the band, and I tried to tell them to act like they're like responsible and mature and not cheese out on you, and they might have cheesed out just a little bit, but they weren't too bad. But we were excited to be at the show. It was a great show. But I remember you telling me beforehand as we were walking over there that, you know, they had told you it was going to be a bigger turnout, and the promoter guy or whatever was saying, yeah, sorry, it didn't become what it was. And so I knew that you guys had been told, kind of sold a little bigger crowd than what was delivered. Watching you guys play, I thought you guys did great. I thought you guys killed it. I don't really know how to judge that kind of stuff, but I thought you guys did wonderful. I thought it was amazing. And I'm wondering, like, as a band who's been playing for 20 years, you've clearly done huge shows, and you've done some shows that didn't turn out to be what you thought they were going to be. Like, how is it that you guys act like professionals and like show up and do your work even when you don't feel like it and even when the crowd's not there? Is there something that you've learned over those years? Because I'm sure many of us pastors have had that feeling like, oh, I thought this was going to be a different kind of event, and lo and behold, it's not. But we still need to perform. We still need to do our best.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the thing is that, you know, I mean, it is about being a professional. But I also think it's about just honoring the people that are there. You know, I think that it's like you can't really discount, you know, like they're there, they paid money, and we're super grateful that they're there, you know.
Yeah.
I think that the one thing that you do appreciate over the course of time is like, you know, over the course of 20 years of us playing together, the thing you do appreciate are like, yeah, a show may not have sold as many tickets as we had liked, but it doesn't mean that like we're not stoked to play for the people that are there, you know? And you know, at the like the base level of everything, like we're in Fort Worth, we're playing music, it's really fun, and these people have come out to come see it, and we're gonna like, you know, so I think you just sort of tap into the, you know, kind of a similar thing what I was talking about with church. It's like there's sort of like if you just sort of take a step back and like look at what's happening, like you're on a stage in Texas playing music outdoors to a crowd, and it's really fun, and you know, it's hard to really get, you know, if you're sitting there getting upset because there aren't more people there or something like that, then I think that you're not really going to be playing a good show. Like you're not going to be giving the people there something that, you know. So I mean, I think if you start doing it that way, you start to discount the experience of people who paid to come and that's in the long run, like even if you wanted to look at it as like just sort of really cold business perspective. Like, if you don't play a great show, then the people that are there aren't going to come back, and the crowd's going to be even smaller. So it's
So
I think part of it is just, you know, it's all of those things combined to just try to be professional and get people what they paid for.
I appreciate that you said multiple times that we're in Texas. So what I hear you saying is that you understand how awesome Texas is.
Oh, yeah. And Texas is amazing. Yeah.
Exactly. That's good. Zach, it's always fun to talk with you. Thanks for the time, man. It's been a blast.
Yeah, thanks, Luke. Take care,
man. Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.